What then must we do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution, democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up, by Garl Purvitz. Part 3, Checkerboard, Emergent Municipal and State Possibilities. Chapter 10, How the Conservatives Buried Adam Smith, and What It Might Mean for Us. What about government? How does it relate to what we've been talking about, and might begin to talk much more about, especially, first, at the local community level? Might it have a significant role to play in advancing the democratizing direction we have been discussing? A good place to begin to explore the question is with a brief word about old Adam Smith, the father of modern free market economics, and about his former conservative allies. It used to be, long, long ago, that some genuine conservatives generally believed in the free market. Here, for instance, is conservative Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman. The only way that has ever been discovered to have a lot of people cooperate together voluntarily is through the free market. And here are the views of another Nobel-winning conservative economist, Friedrich Hayek. I regard the preservation of the system of free markets and the private ownership of the means of production as an essential condition of the very survival of mankind. Now, if the free market really worked in the wonderful way Friedman and Hayek imagined, propelled entirely by elective individual behavior, I would take them seriously, even though there are lots of reasons to believe that this is wildly utopian, not in Mannheim's sense, but in the real-world sense. But it does not. Friedman, Hayek, and countless others describe the economy in ways that simply ignore the vast role of government in virtually all so-called free market enterprise. Indeed, and here's the thing to note about our own time in history, especially at the local level we've been talking about, but also, as we shall see, at the state and national level, it's been a long, long, long time since anybody really acted as if they believed any of the old free market shibboleths in the real world, especially most conservatives. The truth is, business uses government all the time, irrespective of free market theory, and again, particularly at the local level where the action has gotten really intense in the last few decades. When progressives and conservatives crossfire over free market issues, the battle is often constructed to be over how much influence government should have in the marketplace, with most conservatives pushing the notion that government involvement disrupts the natural flow of a free market. That may be handy framing toward off-wanted regulations, but even free market evangelists know the market commonly stands on government legs. Consider, for example, the vast amounts of government, taxpayer, money used to bribe big corporations to invest in cities. Lots and lots of examples of this now conventional process can be found in almost every metropolis. Moreover, it is now estimated that big companies often extract public subsidies of between $100,000 and $200,000 per promised job brought to a city. The practice, however, dubious to begin with, is also ripe for abuse. A classic example, but really only an illustration of a general practice, involved the Marriott Corporation, a company that between 1997 and 1999 threatened to move its 4,000 employee headquarters facility from Bethesda, Maryland to suburban Virginia. In exchange for an agreement to stay, Marriott got state and local officials to provide multiple subsidies worth between $49 million and $74 million, the precise amount depending on the company's future growth. Subsequently, an investigation by the Baltimore Sun found that Marriott had never planned to leave. Indeed, it informed the state of Virginia it wasn't moving a month before Maryland made its offer. The threat had simply been a tactic to extract more money from the state and county leaders as executives played one group off against another. Ask your conservative friends who urge such programs to square that with Adam Smith, the free market, and all the traditional posturing. Then ask their business friends if they will disdain from accepting the big public bucks in connection with business strategies they might be contemplating. By the way, in the real-world businesses that extract large subsidies from municipalities and states often move on, leaving them high and dry as they look for another place willing to play the same game. In 2004, for example, North Carolina amassed a package of benefits valued around $242 million to encourage Dell to build a $100 million computer assembly plant to employ 1,500 people. Dell also collected an additional $37.2 million in local economic development subsidy dollars from Forsyth County and Winston-Salem. The overall cost to the taxpayer amounted to more than $200,000 per job. But in October 2009, Dell announced that it would be closing its four-year-old facility and would instead outsource most of the 900 jobs to plants in Mexico. The absurdity, waste, and ideological dishonesty involved in such now conventional processes and now conventional conservative blather about free markets is one thing. Quite another, and much more important, is how profoundly things have changed in the direction of explicit government economic planning at the local level, we'll explore national later, all largely at the behest of businessmen and free market conservatives. And this is, in turn, suggests some new possibilities for democratization as well. In city after city, government officials now routinely use tax incentives, tax abatements, loan guarantees, loans, special zoning, public-private joint ventures, and many other economic tools as a way to encourage business to develop. They have done so precisely because the free market operating on its own often simply results in local economic dislocation and decay. Recent trends take us far beyond garden variety tax deals and other routine strategies that disregard free market theory. A big trend in many cities these days involves explicit public investment in specific businesses. Socialism, if you like. Two respected urban policy experts, Susan Clark and the late Gary Gale, have underscored the speed with which the strategy became conventional once it got underway. They found that in 1989, a mere 5.4% of the city surveyed, population over 100,000, were engaged in venture capital investing. By 1996, there was a six-fold increase to 33.2% doing direct venture capital investing. Even more impressive was the trend in connection with equity investing. In 1989, 20.4% of cities surveyed were making direct municipal equity investments in local businesses. By 1996, a majority, 56.3%, were doing so as part of their routine development strategy. Another leading local economic development expert, Peter Eisinger, describes what municipalities now do on a routine basis as the new entrepreneurial state. A common strategy involves establishing a local economic development corporation to channel municipal investments to specific businesses. In addition, such corporations issue revenue bonds, own and maintain industrial parks, employ revolving loan funds to make below-market loans to businesses, use tax increment financing to subsidize business development, and provide tax abatements to encourage business formation in targeted sectors. I could list many more techniques that are now commonplace. We also could spend a long, long time deciding when this is in the public interest and when not, but let's pass on that for the moment. There is a huge literature. From the larger perspective we have been exploring, there is a much more interesting thing to note. Namely, once we recognize that government is now inevitably involved in many, many economic development issues, a very different question becomes obvious. Couldn't such involvement help support the developing movement toward democratized businesses as well? Indeed, why not make this a priority? Virtually all the things that are now routinely done for business in general can, in fact, also be done for co-ops, social enterprises, and non-profit land development efforts. Indeed, in the most interesting developing efforts, that is precisely what is already happening every day more and more in the real world. Again, let's take a look at Cleveland. The Department of Housing and Urban Development Section 108 and BEDI, Brownfields Economic Development Initiative, funds helped clear land for the greenhouse. Department of Treasury New Markets tax credits helped support the laundry. Ohio solar renewable energy certificates have played a role in the solar co-op installation work. City of Cleveland NSP, Neighborhood Stabilization Program, grants and Department of the Commerce EDA, Economic Development Administration, working capital loans helped the overall effort. And in San Diego's Market Creek Plaza, government support came from such programs as the Federal New Markets Tax Credits, tax reimbursements from the Southeastern Economic Development Corporation, and a low-interest loan through Clearinghouse, CDFI, with help from the California Southern Small Business Development Corporation. Further, work will draw upon additional public funds, including $1.35 million in a Brownfield Remediation Award, which in turn will give the project priority status with 11 state agencies, putting it at the front of the line with each for additional funding. Federal strategies to support economic development and related efforts obviously come in many forms. 2, however, may serve to further illustrate what is now conventional practice. The Community Economic Development Program of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services funds a wide range of projects. In Tampa, Florida, a community development corporation was able to use federal funds to make a $759,000 equity investment in the 22nd Street Retail Center, which will bring healthy food to a neighborhood that, lacking grocery stores with fresh food, has been a food desert. A very different form of now conventional public policy involves the very large order tax benefits, roughly $2 billion per year, given to business people who sell at least 30% of their company to their workers in ESOP efforts. I'm less interested here in hypocrisy, how business people and conservatives continually spout rhetoric about how and why the free market must keep government away from business. The big point is not about the hunger of conservative business people for subsidies. It is that government now routinely uses taxpayer money and other programs to achieve economic goals. And this historical reality opens up many interesting new questions and possibilities for supporting the various efforts we have been examining in the previous chapters. In parts 5 and 6, we'll take a deeper dive into all this, exploring why such public efforts are important to any thoughtful developmental approach to large order change. Most significant at this point is simply this. If you're going to get serious about systemic change, not just projects, you're ultimately going to have to consider what government does and how it can be used to further the vision and model you affirm. If you don't, somebody else will, all the while denying or obfuscating what they are doing. Which also means that we need to begin to think in specific, practical, and serious terms about adding to our longer-term democratization strategy, both policy and politics that support specific institutional development efforts. And yes, the question over time is whether this can move beyond developing models to real scale. And yes, that depends on pain levels, the nature of the emerging context, and whether a common direction is embraced. And yes, we will get deeper into all this too, especially in part 6. One more local thing before we move on, something pretty obvious but worth a reminder. In a number of cities, folks have gotten pretty hip to the reality that government itself also must be, and should be, directly involved in any serious new longer-term strategic approach, especially now, given that the environment is a central concern. Not only are they already helping democratized economic efforts, but they are using municipal powers that suggest new and truly impressive additional directions, directions that are feasible as part and parcel of any larger community institution building and democratizing strategy, and feasible now. Famously, municipal efforts in Portland, Oregon have paved the way through the city's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, BPS. For one thing, the BPS is helping implement a major climate action plan to reduce the city's carbon emissions by 80% from 1990 levels by 2050. Other initiatives include Clean Energy Works Portland, a nonprofit designed to help finance energy improvements in 6,000 homes by 2013, transit-oriented development, including developments around the city's new and expanded tram system, solar energy, aiming to install at least 10 megawatts of solar capacity in the city, waste reduction and recycling programs, designed to increase recycling to 75%, new eco-districts, such as the Rose Quarter, neighborhood greenways, where bicycles are given priority over automobiles, the River Plan, to promote industrial development while at the same time reducing environmental destruction, and city government sustainability programs designed to save the city $4 million a year in energy costs. The out-of-the-box Portland tale in the Pacific Northwest, however, is by no means the only one. In Kansas City, Missouri, the Municipal Green Impact Zone has brought together public and private resources to transform decaying neighborhood into a sustainable urban community. The effort includes school improvements, weatherization, job training and placement programs, business development initially targeted at improving energy efficiency, renewable energy and water conservation programs, installation of a smart grid by Kansas City Power and Light, and new programs to develop housing on abandoned lots, remove dangerous buildings, enforce code violations, and ensure rental property maintenance. In Austin, Texas, another green municipal development initiative is working to build a regional economy that emphasizes green business leadership, clean technology, new jobs, and expanding opportunity. The city supports local companies that green their operations, offering awards, free online and print advertising, networking opportunities, and the like. It also includes an effort slated to make the city's operations completely carbon neutral by 2020, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions by switching to renewable energy, replacing inefficient lighting, and replacing vehicle fleets, plus, among other things, conservation programs covering water, air, quality, waste reduction, recycling, and green gardening. In Oberlin, Ohio, and the city at Oberlin College have embarked on the ambitious Oberlin Project, aimed at radically transforming the city economically, socially, and environmentally. The project includes development of a 13-acre green arts district of new and renovated environmentally advanced buildings, creation of environmentally sustainable, democratically owned businesses in the energy, food, and agricultural sectors, transition of both the city and college to renewable energy delivered by locally owned and operated sources, creation of a 20,000-acre green belt to provide locally grown food to the city and to increase employment and study opportunities, formation of an educational partnership among Oberlin College, Oberlin Public Schools, and community colleges and vocational schools to foster a curriculum based on sustainability, and an effort, finally, to replicate the project on different scales in cities and regions across the country. Many, many more tales like these are available to draw upon for those who want to get serious about using government in new ways, first to boost democratizing efforts, but also to mobilize the entire panoply of municipal and other policies in a new direction. So onward, perhaps even offering condolences to old Adam, if you like, and even thanks to his many conservative followers who have been all too happy to face and use, and teach us how to use, the real world of public policy and everyday practice, all the while marvelously unable to resist denying that use at every possible turn of the political debate.